Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
What can you learn about chicken intelligence by watching your very own personal flock?
Their social lives are exquisitely important to them. Belonging to a flock is what matters.
It's Thursday, November 7th, and you're listening to Science Friday. I'm Sci-Fi producer Charles Bergquist. This episode, two stories about our relationship with birds. In a bit, a trip out to Antarctica, where we'll hear how tourist photos can help ecologists studying penguin colonies. But first, guest host Rachel Feltman talks with naturalist and author Cy Montgomery about her new book, What the Chicken Knows. Here's Rachel.
I want to spend some time with another popular bird, chickens. They don't exactly have a reputation of being the sharpest creatures in the animal kingdom. I mean, it's hard to think of another animal whose major claim to fame is running around with its head cut off. But talk to anyone who raises chickens, and they'll tell you that these birds are far more intelligent and social than we often give them credit for. My next guest is among that flock and has firsthand experience of the bond between human and chicken. Cy Montgomery, author of the new book, What the Chicken Knows, A New Appreciation of the World's Most Familiar Bird. She's based in Hancock, New Hampshire. Cy, welcome to Science Friday.
Oh, I'm thrilled to be here.
So how has your understanding of chickens changed since you first started keeping them?
Well, I kind of went into having our first flock with beginner's mind, and I didn't really have any expectations except that I knew I would love them. Whatever they wanted to show me, I was going to be thrilled. And sure enough, day one, I was absolutely gobsmacked. I got a flock from my dear friend Gretchen Morin. It was a housewarming or barnwarming present. And she had raised these chicks at her house. And my husband and I went over to visit them when they were tiny, fluffy chicks. And when they were old enough, they came to live in our barn. Well, I was absolutely certain that the minute I let them out of the barn, they'd become lost on our 8 acres of fields and woods. But Gretchen told me, just leave them in 48 hours. And when you let them out, they'll know where they live and they will know to come home at night. And I got to tell you, when I was a kid, one time we moved to a new house and I was literally lost in the backyard, but these chickens not. And there have been scientific studies showing that these birds have incredible spatial abilities, that they can find the center of any given area instantly, even in the absence of landmarks and even without ever having been there before. They are really, really good at finding out where everything is and understanding what their territory is, which I am not.
I was going to say, that sounds like they're better at that than I am. So, chickens have these surprising innate skills, but what do they learn over time?
Well, they remember the past and they anticipate the future. And that sounds like, wow, gee, that's fantastic. But of course, you know, this has enormous evolutionary value for almost everybody. Because if you don't remember the past, you can't anticipate the future and you can't be an active participant in your own fate. So my hens, for example, remembered predator attacks and they remembered the places that they had successfully hidden in the past. They also remember at least, and this has been found also by researchers, that chickens can remember at least 100 different faces. And that's chicken faces, but they remember our faces as well. And they look at your face just like you would look at your friend's face. You recognize your friend even if they're wearing an overcoat or if they're wearing a bathing suit by looking at their face. And these researchers discovered that when they dressed up chickens in costumes, as long as they left their faces okay, they too were able to find their friends even when they were wearing something else. But if you messed with their combs or their beaks or their wattles, it was like putting a mask, a Halloween mask, on somebody. They couldn't tell who their friends were.
Wow, that's very impressive and also sounds like a completely delightful study.
Dressing chickens, wouldn't that be a good job?
So you've talked about, you know, how devoted you are to your chickens. What do we know about how chickens sort of make sense of their relationships with their human caretakers?
Well, to a chicken, your social life is really everything. Your flock is your cohesive social unit. It's your community. And that can include people in the flock, just like I certainly include animals in my family, even if they're not, you know, human or genetically related to me. We all feel that way. But my chickens were able to perceive a subtle change in our relationship with our neighbors, even before we did. This was the amazing thing. For a long time, we lived next door to this nice man, and we would see him every once in a while, and we'd help each other out when we needed. Then he moved away. Well, all during this time, our hens never jumped on the low stone wall that separated our properties, even though their barn was closer to the neighbor's house than to ours. Well, the next folks to move in after the house had sat vacant was this great family of a mom and her two kids, age 7 and 9, and they fell in love with our black and white spotted pig, Christopher Hogwood, and soon they were over the house every day, playing with the pig, playing with our dog, and playing with our chickens. And we were over their house as well. And that was when I noticed this profound change in our flock's behavior. They had never before jumped over that low stone wall, even though there were certainly delicious bugs and worms over there. But when they perceived that our two households had become one unit, immediately they annexed the neighbor's property.
Wow, that is really cool. One thing that I found really interesting and hadn't really thought about before reading your book is that a lot of people who keep backyard chickens only keep hens. So why do roosters get such a bad rap?
Oh, it's very sad. I mean, in some cultures, roosters are revered, and justly so. Some cultures say that when a rooster crows, it's because he's seen an angel. And I love that idea.
Yeah.
But a lot of people in suburban areas, I think, are disturbed to have someone crowing early when they'd rather sleep late. And the other thing that can happen, doesn't happen all the time, but sometimes your rooster can turn on you and start attacking people. Now, the reason for this is that he's defending his flock. Hmm. And I found this out one time in an infamous moment when our minister came to visit. He was bringing over his new fiance and her two small children and wanted to enchant them with our petting zoo. And they were a little frightened by the 750-pound pig when he came bucking out of his stall with his razor-sharp tusks. So he said, well, kids, let's meet somebody more your size. And he started petting one of my hens. Well, what you do when you pet a hen is you start at their head and you go over their back, and the hen will often crouch and raise her arms a little bit, her wings a little bit. And what this is known as is the sex crouch. And it's a position that she assumes so a rooster can jump on her and mate with her. Mm. Well, of course, Graham didn't realize he was doing anything wrong, but our rooster looked up from across the barnyard and he saw our minister having sex with one of his hens. So he came rushing over and he had these big spurs and he attacked our minister, who unfortunately was wearing shorts.
Oh, no.
And bloodied his legs, terrified the children, upset the new fiance. Complete failure of a visit.
Well, and tell me about your neighbor who actually runs a rooster rescue. You know, how is she able to soothe their more aggressive tendencies?
Well, Ashley Nagley is so awesome. She lives catty-cornered across the street from us. And frankly, although we have acres of land, but I never hear them crowing. But she started rescuing unwanted roosters who had turned and people were afraid their kids were going to be hurt, roosters who people just didn't like them crowing and dumped them in the woods. And what she says you should do to turn a rogue rooster into a gentleman is completely counterintuitive. She told me what you should do is pick them up and cuddle them.
Wow.
Carry them around while you're doing your chores. Just give them love. It is the most amazing thing. It doesn't seem like anything you would normally do because roosters, you know, they've got sharp beaks and they've got sharp spurs and people justly fear them. But she says, you know, pick them up in a blanket or a towel to keep those spurs away. Don't keep his beak particularly near your eyes. But if you keep carrying him around and cuddling him, he will turn into the best friend you ever had.
So I know you've kept a bunch of different breeds over the years. Do you have a favorite?
Well, our first flock, they were entirely a breed called Black Sex Lynx. And one wonderful thing about Black Sex Lynx is that the chicks, you can tell just by looking at their color, which ones are going to grow up to be ladies and which might be roosters, because you don't want to have a whole barnyard full of roosters. They will often fight if there are any hens at all. They are very jealous husbands. So that was pretty awesome. They were beautiful birds. They had, you know, red combs, upright combs, and they were very tolerant of the cold, and they laid delicious brown eggs. But later we had some other breeds, including Lakenvelders, which is it's a word that means a shadow on a sheet. And they were white with beautiful black markings on their tail feathers and their wings. And we had Dominiques, a heritage breed related to the barred rock. I never actually met a chicken I didn't like.
So you've obviously thought about chickens quite a bit. What's your favorite chicken fact?
I think any of the facts about how smart they are, that they can remember 100 faces, that each one has their own personality, and that their social lives are exquisitely important to them. Belonging to a flock is what matters. And this is something that really matters in human life, too. It's something that we admire, and we should recognize it in these chickens rather than dismiss them as these stupid, dirty, feathered automatons. Nothing could be further from the truth.
Absolutely. Sai, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, it was my pleasure.
Sai Montgomery, author of the new book, What the Chicken Knows, A New Appreciation of the World's Most Familiar Bird. She's based in Hancock, New Hampshire. If you want to see some pictures of Sai's chickens, which I definitely do, go to sciencefriday.com/chicken. That's sciencefriday.com/chicken.
After the break, how old snapshots of Antarctica could help scientists mine for valuable ecology data. Stay with us.
Support for Science Friday comes from the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, working to enhance public understanding of science, technology, and economics in the modern world.
We've got a few minutes left, so how about we take a quick little trip to Antarctica? If you're lucky enough to make it down there, you'll probably aim to snag a classic photo op, a colony of hundreds of penguins set against the barren landscape. Countless versions of that picture taken over the years could turn out to be a valuable source of ecology data. That's thanks to a technique described this week in the journal PLOS ONE. It uses a computer model to pinpoint those images to a specific location in the Antarctic habitat. Joining me now to talk about it is Dr. Heather Lynch. She's the Institute for Advanced Computational Science Endowed Professor of Ecology and Evolution at Stony Brook University, and she studies penguins in Antarctica. Welcome to Science Friday.
Oh, thank you for having me.
So first of all, would you describe sort of your standard penguin colony for us?
Oh, sure. I'm not sure there is a standard one because actually they range quite a bit in size. So some might only be a couple dozen penguins and some of them will have hundreds or thousands of penguins nesting there. So it can be quite variable and you could have just one species there or multiple species in the same location.
This new approach lets you map out the boundaries of a penguin colony. How does it actually work?
Sure. So one of the big things that my lab has been focused on is trying to track how populations of penguins are changing over time in Antarctica. But scientists can only be in so many places at once. And yet we actually have a very large Antarctic tour industry. And every passenger to the Antarctic has a camera in their pocket. So we wanted to find a way to harness all of this data that are being collected that otherwise we wouldn't have access to. So the idea is that we would want to take a picture of a penguin colony that's taken from the ground, and given no other information about the camera or where the picture was taken, to extract the boundary of the penguin colony and to actually place that in three-dimensional space to figure out where on the world were the penguins, so that we could compare that with a photo that was maybe taken by someone else 3 or 5 or 10 years later, and we could track how the population has changed between those two time periods.
Very cool. So what does this approach give you that, you know, say a satellite image or pictures from a drone might not provide?
Yeah, well, we are very invested in using both drones and satellites. Both are tremendous sources of information and have really revolutionized the way we study penguin colonies. But the drone imagery that we have in particular is only available from the last few years. And satellite imagery only really goes back maybe, you know, 10 or 15 years if we're talking about the highest resolution imagery that we're now using. So what we wanted to do was develop a method that would allow us to go back to historic photos of the Antarctic and locate those. We call it georeferencing. We want to georeference those images so that we could compare the data that we're collecting now from drones and satellites to those photographs that may have been taken before those other sources of data were available to scientists.
We're talking about, you know, the changes in boundaries of penguin colonies. How much are they really changing in position over time?
So one of the things that's remarkable about penguins is that they are very site faithful. And we know that from comparing some historic air photo data from the earliest days of mapping Antarctica to satellite imagery now, that we know that the population, if there's the same number of penguins, they really are nesting in roughly the same locations as their parents and grandparents and great-grandparents. But the populations, unfortunately, in Antarctica are changing quite a bit due to climate change and other threats. And so when the population is shrinking or growing, those are the changes that we can track now using photographs in addition to the other sources that we've talked about, such as drone imagery or satellites.
Hmm. And I'm assuming that not every tourist penguin pic will work for this. So what do folks need to make sure is in the image to make sure that it's going to be useful?
So, you know, your classic close-up photo of an individual penguin is not going to do us a lot of good because we won't have enough context to know where that penguin was. And at the same time, if it's too much of a landscape photo and the penguins are in the deep, deep distance, it's going to be too far away. So ideally, what we have is a photograph that shows enough of the colony that we can actually extract its boundary, but also enough of the context like ridges and coastline that it helps the computer models locate that image in sort of three-dimensional space relative to our models of these islands.
And are there any other, you know, limits on how well this can work? You know, does snow impact the data at all?
Well, snow is a really interesting problem and one of the reasons why this has been such a challenge in the Antarctic. This idea of creating three-dimensional models of locations based on photographs is actually not particularly new. And there's a word for that. It's called phototourism, where people take these ad hoc tourist photos and could reconstruct, say, you know, the city of New York City. But in the Antarctic, we don't have buildings or other sharp edges that would make it easier for the computers to reconstruct the scene in three dimensions. And as you mentioned, the snow is constantly changing in the Antarctic. So every photograph taken of the Antarctic, even the same location 2 days in a row, will look quite different. And so that's one of the reasons why this was a challenging computer vision problem, is how do we accommodate those changes in what the scene looks like. And so we had to rely very much on the fact that the terrain is quite static. You know, the island surface is not changing between days, even if a lot of the things on the surface, like the snow, is changing.
Yeah, well, and speaking of, you know, the starkness of the landscape, could researchers potentially use this in locations where there's more going on visually, you know, trees, vegetation?
Absolutely. And in some ways, what we've done is solved the hard version of the problem. And I think other locations on the planet will be easier than the Antarctic. So, for example, one of the areas where I'm most interested in applying this, or I think it could make the biggest difference, would be in georeferencing photographs of glaciers. So if we think about, well, how are the glaciers of the Alps changing through time? This kind of approach would allow us to take photographs from climbers through the decades and to georeference them on the Earth so we could see how the glacier had been changing over decades. Or another application would be looking at the location of flowers in a field, if we wanted to know the timing of flowering or how a particular species of flower had been changing over time, we could use photographs taken from people going to, say, national parks, and we could use the same process there. So it's quite a general problem that we've solved, but it turns out that in places like the Antarctic, where we don't have a lot of visual cues that would allow us to figure out where a camera was when it took the photograph, that was the computer science challenge that we were trying to solve. And so this allows us to use it not just in the Antarctic, but pretty much everywhere else where you might have a little bit more information about where you are.
You know, I think a lot of people listening to this will be really interested in how their photos today can be useful for research. But could you theoretically, you know, go back to a scan from an old textbook or encyclopedia and use that picture to pull useful information?
Absolutely. The estimates are now that there are 5 billion pictures taken every day, but people didn't just start taking photographs. You know, people have been taking photographs of the planet for 100 years. And so one of the challenges that environmental scientists face is trying to match the current conditions to those conditions that existed before all the modern data collection that we have now. And so these historic photos that might be in a textbook or it might be in a museum somewhere, they provide this picture of what the planet looked like before the climate change impacts that we're seeing now. So it's really looking back at this archival imagery that I think this approach that we've developed here would be most useful.
And what kind of research questions could you try to answer using these older photo sources?
In the Antarctic in particular, we're very interested in how the ice environment has changed, both the depth of the snow, but in particular, the retreat of certain glaciers. We can look at volcanic processes that might have changed the shape of the landscape. We can look at the spread of vegetation. So there was a really nice paper that was published recently by another group that was talking about the greening of Antarctica. Those are exactly the kinds of questions that we can start to ask now going back to the historic imagery, because we can say, oh, here's an image from 1967 or 1985. That plant is not in this location. And we know that because we have a photograph that we can place in real space and we can see that that plant is not there 60 years ago, but it is there now.
Mm. And getting back to penguins, I know your lab has another approach for tracking their movements, which is looking at their poop from space. Could you tell us a little bit more about that?
Sure. So one of the ways that my lab is studying penguins is actually to use satellite imagery, but we're not using satellite imagery to see individual penguins. What we're doing is actually looking at the poop stain that these colonies create on the landscape. And that can be seen from 400 miles away up in space, which is pretty remarkable. So a lot of my research effort is focused on using computer science tools, computer vision and AI, to automate the search for penguins in that satellite image and to use it to actually track their abundance through time.
And what is the big goal here? You know, why is it important to know where penguin colonies are getting to?
Well, these penguin populations are changing rapidly, and we know that is due to a variety of factors that include climate change, but also fishing. We have a large Antarctic tourism industry. These are all of the factors that we're tracking that might be explaining why we're seeing declines in some species, we're seeing growth in other species. The Antarctic Peninsula is one of the most rapidly warming places on the planet, and we really see that reflected in the Antarctic penguins and in their distribution and abundance. So we are using them in many ways as like the canary in the coal mine for the Antarctic ecosystem, because we know the ecosystem is changing rapidly and the penguins are telling us, they're giving us a window into that world.
Very cool. Well, that's all the time we have for now. Dr. Heather Lynch is the Institute for Advanced Computational Science Endowed Professor of Ecology and Evolution at Stony Brook University in Stony Brook, New York. Thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, it was my pleasure.
That's it for today. Tomorrow, we'll check in on some of the top stories from the week in science. Lots of folks help make this show happen every day, including
Emma Gomez,
Sandy Roberts,
Robin Kasmer,
Kathleen Davis.
I'm Charles Berquist. Thanks for listening. We'll see you soon.